is June 4th, 2020. Eli Zarrett, Denny McClain, Bob Page with another edition of No Filter Sports, as there is no sports. And we're going to have to be careful with our filter today. We do have a filter in at times. That's when it comes to politics and religion and things like that that enter the conversation from outside the sports world. But I think with the Drew Brees comments and the backlash to that, we're going to have to talk about that a little bit. Let's get into that in a moment. Yesterday, Bob calls me and says, who's our guest for tomorrow? I go, I don't really have anybody. He says, did you see the Free Press that Mick McCabe of the Free Press, so I guess he's been a sports writer there for 50 years, named his 50-year anniversary, whatever it is, of his time in the business. He's, by the way, is a member of the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame for his writing about prep sports, his all-time team. And of the all-time team that included Magic Johnson and Dan Marley and who else is on that? Shane Battier and my memory's.
And Glenn Rice.
Was cool. And Glenn Rice, of course, and who was the second greatest player I ever saw in the state of Michigan next to Irvin. And of course, your fellow University of Michigan alumnus who deserved to be there.
Yes, Campy Russell was the fifth one on the team, but he was actually the oldest because he graduated from Pontiac Central in 1970. What an incredible career he had. I met him at Michigan because I graduated in 72 when he was a sophomore there, but I wasn't a sports reporter yet. I'd been told by my professor that my voice was too quirky to be behind the microphone. I should concentrate on the technical elements of sports. So I became a cameraman at the TV center, although I think it was a local cable. So we used to record, tape the Michigan basketball and football games and play them back on local cable. Then, of course, later I became a sports reporter. And you ready for this, Bob? He told me this yesterday. So he's the eighth pick overall in the draft after an incredible year at Michigan, All-American his junior year, and he turns pro. I want to talk about hardship. He was a hardship case. Think of this, Denny. Back then, you had to show your father's tax return to prove that you needed the money.
Yeah.
Oh, and you had to prove you were a hardship case. So if your father made too much money, you had to stay in college. It's so right. Crazy.
Yeah. hey, let me ask you a question. Do you happen to remember the name of that professor?
Yes, Dr. Edgar Willis.
Well, I remember Dr. David Lewis. He was my advisor at Michigan State University in the Department of Television and Radio. I can still see him. I'm sitting in his office. I told him I wanted to major in TV and radio, and I wanted to be a sportscaster. He looked at me and he says, well, Mr. Page, I'm sure you understand. There are no jobs in television and radio. And I sat there thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing? What am I going to do? There are no jobs. I'm never going to make it. Well, some of these guys got no business advising kids. Well, really don't.
What he did, understand, I'm a freshman in 1968. Television really didn't come to people's households until the 50s. So TV was relatively new. He went back to the early days of television, and his concept was if you didn't have a voice like Walter Cronkite or Edgar R. Moreau, then you couldn't be on radio and television because you needed to have the deep, booming voice. He told me my voice would be a distraction. As it turns out, that was my best asset because it brought awareness that I was different. He completely blew
it. Oh, you sell yourself short. I've always told you you're the best broadcast writer I ever saw on television radio. But you're super smart. You got personality.
Stop it. I don't want
you to sell yourself
short.
Let me quickly finish the story. So 20 years later, after I'm in his freshman class, I come back from New York to work at Channel 2. And he calls me, says, I'm writing a new book, an introduction to radio and television. I want to use you as an example. I go, what do you mean? He says, an example for not to listen to advice and follow your dreams.
So I never got that from David Lewis.
Check this out. The textbook comes out. He sends me a copy of the textbook and he still blows it. Because in the textbook, it said that despite the handicap of my voice, I was still able to forge a successful career. So he still didn't get it by the head of the department at University of Michigan. Anyway, put that aside. So I go way, way back with Campy Russell. And by the way, I was going to say is that when he was with the Cavaliers, he would drive back and forth to Cleveland to see his family in Pontiac. He would record WJZZ because he liked jazz and couldn't get it on the radio anywhere else and would listen driving back and forth to me and then later you on WJZZ.
And then, you know, the last time I actually saw Campy, I ran into Campy. I think it was just 2 years ago. As you know, I come back to Detroit every year for the great Detroit Jazz Festival. I saw Campy at the Jazz Festival, too. I said, Campy, what's going on, man? How you doing? You're still a huge jazz fan.
What a great player he was. was at Pontiac Central, played twice in the state for the state championship, player of the year, Michigan player of the year 2 years in a row, All-American at Michigan, led the Big Ten in scoring his junior year, and then had a great 8-year career in the NBA. So we'll talk to Campy later on. And ironically enough, because we're going to if we do an obituary today, Wes Unseld died over the weekend, and Campy participated, played against him for many, many years, so we'll get his perspective on that. But I guess we need to get to what appears to be the lead story in the non-sports world, and I don't want to – I'll get into later about what the NBA is doing, what Major League Baseball may or may not do. But
let's get to it, though. I mean, we've been on the air now for 35 minutes.
No, 5 minutes and 42 seconds. Give me your opinion. Go ahead, big fella. Lead off.
I'm not going to give you a big opinion, but I will say this. Just think about where the quarterbacks are supposed to be the smartest guys in the NFL, right? Mm-hmm. So we got Kaepernick, who stepped all over his toes 4 years ago. And then we got Drew Brees coming out of the dugout the other day. He's stepping all over his toes again. So what I don't quite understand is how neither one of these guys understood what the other guy was trying to say. Kaepernick never, ever showed – I never thought he showed any disrespect to the flag. People misjudged what Kaepernick was doing. He was doing what he needed to do at that point in time. And as far as Drew goes, Drew did not understand what it was all about. It was obvious. He was obviously in right field someplace.
The big disconnection was that Kaepernick knelt, and in our tradition is we stand for the national anthem. We'll all rise and stand for the national anthem. That's an arbitrary decision. That's how we do it. Kneeling would have been just as legitimate in other cultures, it may be, but we stood. And so when he knelt for the anthem, it was, even though he said this is to protest police brutality, there had been the incident in Ferguson with the kid there and several others, the woman Sandra Bland, black folks killed in the custody of white police departments, et cetera, or at the hands of white officers. But the fact that Kaepernick did it during the anthem, where they usually have military displays, allowed a certain viewpoint to merge those two. It was to project, in deference to the flag. Everybody respects the flag. He respects the flag. LeBron James respects the flag. We all respect the flag and respect our military. It was police brutality that was misconstrued or purposely so to be against the military and against the flag.
And there's other guys involved here that don't understand it either. LeBron didn't understand it at first either. And there's some other guys who popped off. I mean, I've never heard so many people pop off.
I don't know what you mean by that. Besides police brutality?
LeBron says he's going to need 10 guys out there to protect him every time he goes behind the line. I mean,
off against each other, Eli. That's what Denny's saying, I think.
Oh. I mean, yeah, the players going after each other. Oh, this is unusual. Yeah. And then you got other people who still don't want to talk to Kaepernick, and yet Kaepernick was 4 years ahead of himself. Right. I mean, everybody else is just catching up to Kaepernick. I suggest, and I've always said this, I thought he'd get a job. I just didn't think it would take 4 years.
Brees, actually, let's quote him so we don't misinterpret what he's saying. Brees says he supports the equal treatment of minorities by police. That's very important. So we give him credit for that. He sees the reason behind the protest, but he can't manage to differentiate it from an anti-military, anti-American, anti-flag thing. The peaceful protesters are not anti-American. The looters, we put them aside. Those are criminals. They can't be defended. Some are on the right. Some are on the left. That's all reprehensible. You don't destroy property to get your point across. So the small percentage goes against the peaceful demonstration to say, let's just treat everybody equally under the law. Let's be Americans. Let's respect the flag, the military, the police, everybody. But let's clean it up so we're all treated equally. Brees kind of misconstrued that.
And he misunderstood it, right.
He says, what I feel when the national anthem is played, when I look at the flag of the United States, we all feel that too. It's not a perfect country, but it's the best one there is. We're all proud to be Americans. He was saying,
No. We're proud of our Harvard business degrees. We're proud of our medical degrees from the University of Michigan. We're lucky to be Americans.
Yes, we're lucky.
If there's one person you would never, ever think that would say anything in any form, any way negative about the United States of America, would be Drew Brees. I mean, he's all world. He's all NFL. He's a superstar of superstars in the league. He's a football god down in New Orleans. And he's quite a family guy down there. And he's given tens of millions of dollars to the local communities with when the hurricanes hit. And they may have another hurricane coming next week, by the way.
This should be a simple fix.
Yeah.
It should be a very simple fix. We respect Drew Brees, great player. We know he's smarter than this. To just say, to just describe how you can't merge the two, that peaceful protest.
Oh, all he said was, I would never disrespect the flag or the national anthem. Yeah, we're smarter than that. Yeah. Is anything wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with that at all. Nothing wrong with that at all.
But one guy they thought was disrespecting the flag, and the other guy they thought was disrespecting the flag too. And the bottom line with Kaepernick, he was just talking about police brutality. That's all his whole thing was about.
But Denny, you got
somehow or other in the beginning, it got confusing because so many people decided to pop off in the same 10 minutes.
But you got to remember with Kaepernick that it was off the cusp of him wearing the socks that mocked police officers. It was after he had donated money to a woman who was known to kill a police officer. So, you know, there's other factors.
Well, that's our producer, Brandon McAfee. He's had his two cents worth. I'm just going to say this. I am sick and tired of racist white cops murdering innocent black people. I am sick and tired of racist blacks murdering innocent cops. Wednesday night in Brooklyn, the police are just there's a demonstration. Some guy walks up on the street and knifes a police officer in the neck without warning, knifes him in the neck. I'm sick and tired of this whole thing. As that immortal philosopher of 20th century life, Rodney King, once asked rhetorically, why can't we all just get along?
Absolutely.
You're right. In your statement and I'm not going to go there, but your statement demands and almost requires us to go on for about 20 minutes. But there's an awful lot on both sides of the street. And we won't go into the details on both sides. But listen, this is going to be nothing can be fixed here quickly. We're going to have to take our time and unwind all this in some form, one way or the other, and hopefully get some balance. But I suggest, guys, that this is going to wind up like most of the other in 3 or 4 months. People will have forgotten about it or a lot of it, and we will not be making much progress. And I only hope to God that's not true.
Yeah.
Really agree with that. I will say this, since Brandon's already chimed in. He has an adorable little girl. That kid is going to grow up in a much better world than the world in which the three of us.
You think so?
Up.
I hope you're right.
Absolutely. But really? Attitudes are changing. They've changed.
Yeah, young people,
it takes
you're right.
Work. It takes work at this. But the young kids, and look at all the white kids who are out there.
Yes.
Even Spike Lee was saying, I was so gratified to see this wasn't just a black demonstration thing. The world will be better.
Yes, yes. This is and this younger generation is the least prejudiced of any that we've ever had.
Just to
clarify, what LeBron James said was to Brees, you literally still don't understand why Cap was kneeling on one knee. Has absolutely nothing to do with the disrespect of our soldiers, men and women who keep our land free. My father-in-law was one of those. So I think a simple conversation. I'd love to see Brees and LeBron or a few people do a little TV, a little interview and straight, because we all seem to agree that equality is what our country was hopefully built on, even though it's taken a long time to get there and maybe get closer, like you say.
And you know, the PC posse is adding to the problems all the time.
Absolutely.
This guy, I don't know who this guy is. I've never really heard of him. Apparently, he's almost like, not to that degree, quite. He's almost like the George Blaha of Sacramento, Grant Napier. He's only been the Kings radio broadcaster since 1988.
Yeah,
32 years.
Ridiculous.
He was fired by the team due to his answering a question from former Kings star DeMarcus Cousins, who asked Napier for his opinion on the Black Lives Matter thing. All he said was, all lives matter, every single one. And who can disagree with
who
that?
Who can disagree with that? It's, I know.
But he's gone. Now, and to make it even worse, the next day, in an apology published by the Sacramento Bee, Grant Napier said, I'm quoting, I'm not as educated on Black Lives Matter as I thought I was. I had no idea that when I said all lives matter, that it was counter to what BLM is trying to get across. It's just, I'm sorry, all lives matter, folks. And if you don't like it, tough.
So a lot of this is centered, obviously, in professional sports. And let me just ask you guys a question. You think talking about the race and racism, will Floyd's death change the way players will relate to each other? You really believe they will?
No, I think sports seems to me to be as about as racially neutral as any entity in America. Players play together. They recognize the qualities each brings to the game. There's as much respect as possible, depending on how people are brought up and what their beliefs are, of interacting, of being teammates. And I think it's been nice that it's interesting that so many players have commented on this, because it seems like we have something we can all agree on now. And so that's why I don't think Brees and LeBron James and Aaron Rodgers are that far off. Rodgers said on Instagram, it has never been about the anthem. Not then, not now. Listen with an open heart. Let's educate ourselves, then turn the word and thought into action. And he shows a picture of he and his teammates arm in arm with his black teammates. They didn't kneel. They weren't allowed to kneel because that became symbolically toxic. Mm-hmm. And so I think most of them are on the same page.
Well, but basically, the point you just made apparently isn't true, at least thanks to, again, to the mindless PC posse. Here comes Denver Broncos head coach Vic Fangio, who apologized on Wednesday of this week for saying, imagine this, he stood up and said, you know, I don't really see any racism at all in the NFL. He went on to apologize for that after people criticize him. So if that's how he feels, that's fine. And remember, music and sports are the two greatest things in breaking down racial barriers in this country, because they're your brothers. You live and die with them every day. Guys respect each other. You know, ask Denny McClain about that. You know, mm-hmm. how the 68, 69 Tigers were with Willie and Gator and all those guys on the team. I mean, it's just crazy, some of the stuff that we're seeing.
Well, yeah, I just don't think that we're going to change much in the dynamics of a locker room because this poor fellow got killed. I think it's drawn a lot of attention to a big problem, but I do not think that whatever needs to be done, and I'm not smart enough to identify it, and you guys probably are, but I'm just telling you that this is a long way from making peace. And I'm just afraid of it going off again in the next night or three.
There's so many things going on. But, you know, the D.C. officers knelt with demonstrators Wednesday.
Yeah, sure.
Coral Gables, police and protesters came together. The majority of policemen are good, dedicated people that are willing to put their lives on the line to protect.
Absolutely.
Like, so much.
I'll tell you how to settle
for the
it.
Police. So I'll much. But so the point being is that police departments need to get better at policing themselves, at being able to whistleblow on an officer who's doing something wrong. We can all work together on this to make it better. We've come a long way.
If you have the police live back in the city that they police in, that's the first step. Number two, and have these stations that Detroit started a number of years ago with local stations that policemen can hang out in neighborhoods. That brings people together. It brings people to the police. The police and everybody, they start to get along. They start to trust each other. And isn't trust the bottom line when it comes to the police department mm-hmm. and the general public? And that's what we have to do. We have to get closer to the people that we trust to do the things that we can't do ourselves.
Yeah. Now, dig this. Florida State has a big star defensive lineman named Marvin Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
So they also have a head coach named Mark Norvell, who announced that he had reached out to players individually to discuss last week's death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And Wilson said he and his teammates would not be working out until further noticed. Apparently, they're going to go on strike. Can you imagine this? A college football team? What? In a post to Twitter early this morning, Thursday, as we record this, Wilson disputed that Mike Norvell ever had one-on-one discussions with players about this. He said FSU players only received a generated text from Norvell. And the quote from Wilson is, "This is a lie. And me and my teammates as a whole are outraged, and we will not be working out until further notice." Now, it's a different era. I understand that.
But with all due respect,
possibly imagine a University of Michigan? Denny,
let him finish.
Go ahead.
Possibly imagine a University of Michigan football player who was still on the team publicly calling Bo a liar? But that's what's going on now.
Wow. Well, go ahead, Denny. Do you want to say something?
Whatever the point was, I missed the point. That's all. I was just asking to repeat the point because you completely lost me.
The point was that a player accuses coach of lying, and they're on strike until that it's settled. I found it.
Does that make sense to you? You got 50, 60, 70 people on the team, and you're going to start telling lies?
He said he reached out to every single player on the team, I presume the black players especially, to talk about what happened in Minneapolis. Yeah. And the star player says he's lying. He didn't do that. What a brouhaha they have in Tallahassee, besides our normal government misdoings here in the state of Florida.
Well, life does go on, and David Hall and Hall Financial care about the community of all colors. We want to keep everything peaceful. That's why the team at Hall Financial is working from home to help people save money refinancing. Great time to look at your options and see if maybe refinancing is the right time right now. If you haven't in the last year, you can lower your monthly payment. And by refinancing, you can probably skip up to two payments. And don't worry about the corona situation. Your home could be appraised without somebody stepping inside. They do it with drive-by appraisals. Their service is the fastest in the business. That's why they have nearly 1,500 five-star reviews for Michigan homeowners alone. So go to hallfinancial.com or get started at 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, or personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Okay, let's put this aside.
We were going to talk about baseball, I thought, to start this off. I mean, the show today. I don't think they're going to have a season, Denny. The owners have just rejected the players' 114-game proposal. Now, you recall the last show, I commented that simple arithmetic led me to conclude that the World Series couldn't start until November. And what if games would be played at night, outdoors, up north, in cities where there were not dome stadiums? We do not have to worry about Detroit, of course, being one of those cities. So the owners said, we're not going to play that late in the year. And right now, they haven't even made a counter proposal. They just got to call it off.
I think if, again, like I said a little bit earlier, if they don't get it done by Friday, they're in a lot of trouble. Listen, it takes 4 to 5 weeks for a pitcher to get ready. And I don't care. These guys have not been doing a lot of throwing the last couple of two, three months. So they're going to have to start almost from the ground zero. Yeah, the arms may be a little bit further ahead than what we believe, but you got to do all the other things to get yourself ready. That means covering first base, backing up third, backing up first, doing all of the things that it needs. And that's not learning how to cover first base. That's just one of those exercises that gets you in better shape so you can pitch. And I just don't know where this is going to go. It doesn't look like it's a good – I can't believe the owners at one time wanted to play as many games as they could, and now they're down to 50.
50's kind of a threat.
And here's my question. If you – they now know, based upon all the numbers that we've seen now, every game that they play as a group, they lose $600,000 or $6 million a game. It's an unbelievable figure between all the teams.
Yes, it is counterintuitive how playing more games causes you to lose more money, but you have to play some games so you can get that TV money. But you know, a 50 game season, think of this. The Washington Nationals, the reigning world baseball champions, were 19-31 after 50 games. So baseball is a marathon, not a sprint. They wound up winning the World Series. So what will we have said after a 50-game season when they were 19-31? Should they break the team up? This is, listen, you know, there's a bigger story here. Before we get into the details, you know, I just like to say how sad all this is. For example, we ask people to write in and say, what do you think? Are you missing baseball? How are you coping? Are you getting by? Can you replace it? You can't satisfy the itch. And you know what? Not a single person wrote, which to me says it all. Intelligent people that have other things going on in their lives have managed to replace it. They either go to other entertainment, they read more, they talk to their family more. Who knows? But I don't think anybody but the degenerate gamblers, and maybe, I don't know, younger people besides us who maybe have more interesting lives, I don't know. But maybe people aren't desperate to see the Timberwolves play the Suns at Disney World in August. I'm not. I'm curious if they do it, but I don't care. The clickbait I saw the other day, the clickbait was Khloe Kardashian without makeup. And I'm thinking, this is what sports is now.
How did we segue to that?
I'll tell you that, because that's what it is. This is what the NBA with no fans in Disney World with the Suns playing the Timberwolves in August, that's Khloe Kardashian without makeup. It's ugly, it doesn't look good, and we shouldn't be doing it for the sake of anything. That's what I'm saying.
And Eli, are you so old that if Khloe Kardashian in a negligee knocked on your front door, and Patty, we're not home.
Absolutely.
If she
absolutely.
If you weren't wearing any makeup, you'd say, nah, I don't think so, honey. I'll see you another day. Put on some makeup.
Obviously.
I don't think I would.
It's symbolic, okay? The desperation on the part of the sports leagues trying to contrive something resembling a season out of this was not their doing. I don't blame them. But here's the other issue. Ed, please hear me out, okay?
By the way, they are going to go for 80 games. Watch.
Sports is a business, but a very special business.
Big time.
Very big time, because we have a deep personal, patriotic, and emotional attachment to it. But I have guys come up to me all the time, Al Kaline, how sad Al Kaline, because Al Kaline was a god. You don't have gods in the oil business. You don't have gods in the Walmart, in the sure. retail business, but you have them in baseball. And to strip it down and say, we got to get a season on with no spitting and no high-fiving and no stands, and my teammates got to sit in the stands, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be Kathy Griffin and Khloe Kardashian without makeup on. It ain't going to be pretty, and it's going to hurt for a long time. Okay. Players saying, am I safe? I can't spit. What am I? So, you know, or are we going to put cardboard sex dolls in the stadium like they did, you know, to fill up the stands in Korea? So I don't blame them, but our listeners not responding at all.
I'm very uncomfortable.
Says there's no Kardashian powerful.
And I got to tell you, if Selma Hayek came to my door with no makeup on, it'd be the same situation. I'd open it.
Okay. And same with baseball. You'll go watch baseball, even though there's no, and that's okay. That's okay. Because even without makeup, they're still young and unwrinkled. For guys like us, a dream come true.
But you know, one thing about baseball,
what I'm talking about, leave it to you to trivialize it for me. Go ahead.
But one thing about baseball, that's what we do.
What do we do?
I mean, the three of us, that's what we do. We watch baseball. We watch basketball. We watch football. We watch all of this crazy stuff. I mean,
right.
You know,
but Danny,
think about this though. There are, yes, we do. The three of us do. But there are plenty of people out there, and I'll name a recent guest, Pete Vesey. The only sure. thing Pete's into is the NBA. Of course he likes baseball, but he doesn't watch the NHL. There are a lot of one-trick ponies out there in sports among fans, and that's fine. Right. If you only love baseball, and there are millions and millions of guys out there who only love baseball, they're going to watch. It's baseball.
Well, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I agree. I totally agree.
If nobody is live at the event, then it's a studio game. A home run that no one cheers. It'll sound like the beer league, you know, where a guy hits a home run and the 10 guys on the bench are jumping up and down. It's all you hear. So game is this? You know what? It's a game of charades. Hey, looks like, sounds like, might be baseball.
Right. Think about this. I want you two guys to comment on this. Story just came out on Thursday morning about golf. A decision on whether to go ahead with this year's Ryder Cup loans.
Right.
Steve Stricker is going to be the United States captain, and he said today he is not in favor of playing the Ryder Cup without spectators. He's from Wisconsin, and they're going to be played at Whistling Straits. The Ryder Cup is September 25th to 27th. Stricker said, and I'm quoting him now, this is going to be a yawner of an event and, quote, a crime to Wisconsin fans. You two golf wackos, I mean, I never watch it anyway. Do you want to see the Ryder Cup with no fans?
Well, you know, I think it's closer than the other sports, but still, I'll take you back. When Tiger Woods hit that chip shot on number 16 at the Masters that took a right-hand turn and paused on the lip of the cup for about a second and a half and fell in, and he's pumping his fist and the crowd is going wild, what would that have been like if there had been nobody there? So yes, I will watch it because I can watch golf in silence. I don't need to see it. Right. I just watch and hit the ball. I can turn on an LPGA event from Singapore and I can watch it for a while because their swings are beautiful and I like to see how they play the various shots.
And there's other sports too. I can sit there and watch without volume. I don't need the volume to watch tennis. I mean, I love the game of tennis. There's no reason that you shouldn't be required to have the volume on, for God's sake.
It does strip away the point Stricker is making, and I'm sure this is what, you know, his thought is, that it strips away the emotion that we love in sports. And that's what I was saying about the whole baseball thing. You know, there's an illusion that sports is important. Okay. It's important to the players. It's life and death to the players, to the owners, or not even the owners, but to us, it isn't. And there's this, the illusion of importance. And when you take away the, then it's just a business. Now it's just a business. And you know what I'm going to miss more? What I miss more than sports right now? I hate to say this. I miss restaurants more than I miss sports.
You know what? You're right.
Because if it's not going to be right.
Absolutely right.
All right. Yeah. And there's no cheering in restaurants and there's no high-fiving and there's none of that. But, you know,
chicken wings. I miss my chicken wings, you know.
Now, I live in the free state of Florida. Our restaurants are open. It's all good. So at any rate, as opposed to the not free state,
is that the state of Florida?
Yes, that's the state of Florida.
Is that the state of Florida?
Yes, the free state.
Where they had the big surge this morning?
They had a surge of what?
Yeah, they had a big surge this morning.
Of corona cases?
Yes, sir.
We're getting political again.
Yeah, but corona
cases. That's not political. That's physical.
Danny,
I'm sorry, Bob.
As you know, corona cases only means somebody tested positive for it, not that they're actually sick or they're going to get sick, and certainly not that they're going to die necessarily.
There was a death number. I don't remember what it was.
I'll tell you what. We've, in a state of 23 million people, because of our governor, we've had 2,500 corona deaths. In the state of Michigan, with 11 to 12 million people, almost about half the population,
we've
had more than twice the deaths.
Okay, that's it. Stop.
You're right. Let's stop. But I do want to mention this because we haven't talked about it yet. One of the things I dislike about recording the show as we do is that we fall prey, you know, to timed events. So you folks listening right now, you will know what's going on by the time you listen to this. We unfortunately do not. The NBA's Board of Governors tends to approve a league proposal on a 22-team format. The Pistons will not be part of that.
Of course.
We start the season in Orlando. Now, the conference call and vote is set for 12:30 p.m. Thursday, and as we're recording this, it's already 11:22. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of season they come up with. Again, with no fans, if anybody's going to watch, the NHL is about to announce some kind of summer comeback as well. I mean, they're going to be playing in July and August when the only ice I ever want to see is in the bottom of my gin and tonic.
How about the fact that game seven of the NBA Finals is going to be October 12th? They made sure that's a Monday so it doesn't interfere with NFL football on Sunday.
This is such a no-brainer. Well, don't play the season and go on with the regular schedule. NBA starts November. NHL starts in October.
If they don't get there soon, there's not going to be any kind of a season. NBA, right. I think, is going to start.
They'll get that done. Yep.
Yeah.
So the players are going to live at the complex, which is at Disney World, and they're going to have to all live in the same two hotels. And it's going to be this is going to look like the kids traveling to the tournaments where they sit on the grass between the games. Yeah, and they drink the juice packs and the box lunches. They mill around till they play again. This is what it's going to be, a big round robin tournament. And, you know, Chris Paul will be in the stands when the other teams are playing.
But if that's all you're left, you got to do it. That's all. The players apparently have agreed in the NBA to move forward and get it done. Baseball is the one always has the hang up. They will always have a hang up because there's too many many of us. And, I mean, that's the problem.
And if they canceled the baseball season over Corona, fans would understand. We get that. If they cancel it over labor. No,
that's right.
That's going to be so ugly. Now,
but don't you guys both believe that the perception would be it's the players' fault?
Of course, it always is. That's what Tom Glavine said in 1994.
I don't agree with that. I think the perception is always that it's both of their faults. It's the multimillionaire players against the multibillionaire owners, and neither side cares.
People seem to expect that billionaires make money and that's okay. They don't seem to respect that working guys that become baseball players should be making all that kind of money. That's just a perception, as false as it is, or as phony as it is that you shouldn't be making $20 million a year if you grow up poor and all you can do is play baseball.
All right, Leela, I got one other excuse for you to consider now. Ready for this? The Major League Soccer, MLS Players Association, on Wednesday announced a deal with the owners. They'd been threatening to walk out. They hadn't been working out over money. Details are still being finalized, but we do know this. MLS's 26 teams and limited staff would be based in Orlando, and matches played without fans at ESPN's Wide World of Sports Complex at Disney World. And yes, boys, I just checked. They do not have a domed stadium for outdoor sports. Would you like to play soccer in the heat of Florida in July and August running up and down that field?
I've never been to Florida in July, but I've been to Las Vegas in July, and it's not pretty.
I'll do one better. I have never been in my own home where I am now in the month of June down here, yeah. And it ain't that pretty.
Well, you're there now, and it's June.
Yeah, it's constant rain, and of course it's hot and humid.
But that's.
But okay, I'd still rather go through 10 Florida summers than one Michigan winter. I've always said that.
If they play 82 games,
credibility there.
82 games would be the shortest baseball season since the 1870s. Then you're going to have 14 playoff teams out of 30. Oh, my God. You know, the one thing I really respected about baseball and football, too, the NFL, unlike hockey and basketball, is they kept the playoff field somewhat exclusive. So you don't put everybody in. And you, I think you mentioned it earlier when you talked to John Ziegler, the NHL guy, I don't know, commissioner 40 years ago. And you said, well, gee, you got 16 teams in there. Why not put them all in? And he said, it's not a bad idea. We're considering that.
Right. Yeah, I'll never forget doing that interview with John Ziegler, the Detroit Neighborhoods Commissioner of the NHL. I was at WGR, so it was a long time ago, and that's exactly what I said. I said, you're not going to 16 playoff teams. Yeah, why not put them all? He says, yeah, we're thinking about that, too. Just like a high school basketball tournament.
And I'll tell you something else I like about all these proposals they're making. I mean, there's like a proposal every minute and a half right now from all the sports, but I like the NBA, 7 fouls instead of 6. I like that. They're talking about 7.
Again, I go back to the illusion of importance in sports because it's followed form. Like season 162 games, you know, 3 strikes is an out. When you start making, well, you know what? Let's play baseball fair. Let's make it 3 balls and 2 strikes like they do sometimes in high school. That way we can play more games in fewer days and get through the season. This is the BS that's going to set them back, like the strike in 81 set them back, like the garbage in 94 in a World Series.
Right.
This is going to set them back. And I think, and by the way, I wish we would have talked about it with Trixie. We had Trixie on Dick Trusewski the last show. And when I talked to him on the phone a few days beforehand, I said, what do you think about all this pieces? I just think they should forget it. Come back when you can do the season right, when you can have fans in the stands. Come back next April and do it the right way.
But that's easy to say, Eli, when it's not your money.
I understand.
You know,
I
mean, all they're trying to do is protect some money and protect their assets that are in place now. And what will happen is if they don't play, they're going to wind up with some monster lawsuits that may take years to settle. I just don't think that if you cancel it and you throw everybody out and everybody's discombobulated, because what do we do next year? You've got to start at ground zero, and that's not the way to get this done. You got to put the nail in the wood now.
Whether she's got makeup on or not.
Right.
Whether Chloe's got the makeup on.
And don't ever let her turn sideways.
Come on, Bob. That's not a bad analogy. You ripped into it in the beginning. It's not a bad analogy.
No, it's not a bad analogy. And I didn't want to limit it either to Selma Hayek and the other chick. There are a few others in that same boat.
So some of the ugliness in baseball, though, is what's happened to the minor leaguers. Did you see, terrible. For example, the world champion Nationals? So they're only going to, they wanted to take $100 instead of paying their minor leaguers $400 a month. Think of that, $400 a month.
Right.
Over the course of 12 months, that's $4,800. I don't think they pay them all year round. So over the course of a season, it's $2,400. They wanted to cut it down to $100 in one of their pitchers. Yep. Sean Doolittle said, I'll make up the money. And then the billionaire said, okay, we'll do it. And Scott Boras, who a lot of fans don't understand. They hate him because he does his job so well. That's why they hate him. But he's expected to pay the 2020 salaries of all of his minor league clients who have been or will be released because there's certainly going to be no minor league season in 2020.
Well, you got to be careful about that. Scott Boras is so, so very huge. He's not going to mess around with a lot of minor league clients. And since you're on this subject, I want kudos to go out to the Detroit Tigers, who when Washington was making its announcement about cutting guys in the minor leagues, the Tigers said, we are going to pay all of our minor league kids, just the same as they're making. And I think that's great.
The Royals, the Twins, the Astros, the Red Sox, Pirates also committed to continue to pay their minor league players. So at least somebody's making an effort.
Well, and somebody in the front office is working because they just cut a couple guys up there. A guy named Bo Burrows, who was with that club 5-6 years ago.
Bo Burrows is the number one draft choice in two or three
Bo
years.
No, Bo Burrows is a very important player.
Well, he's not a 40-man roster, and he's not going to be there. And then the next guy is Jacob Robson. They sent him to AAA already, so he's on the minor league side of over in Lakeland.
Yeah, well,
at least somebody's working up there.
You know, it's funny that you say that, though, Denny, because I, you know, when the Lakeland Flying Tigers play down here, and if I'm here into the baseball season, yeah. I'll always go see them play, you know, one of our minor league clubs here. And I specifically went to see Bo Burrows just a couple of years ago, and he looked good. He's a big kid. Big plans, as Eli said, you know, for this guy. The fact that he obviously is not making the progress the Tigers had hoped he would make, that's a concern. I think.
I got news for you. This kid signed in 2015, and he's not even close to the big leagues yet. So they got more of a concern than what we believe.
Well, speaking of concerns, I find it very interesting. I don't quite understand why my 401k is back up to where it was on January 1st, but there's something going on out there in the financial world.
I can't figure it out either.
And I guess since people are coming back to work, the markets seem to be soaring again. And understand what you need to do in your situation. Make some sense out of this by contacting Luke Nowacki at Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. He's the personal wealth manager for us in the Red Shovel Network. He has the highest ethical standards. He's got great energy, got a great work environment, great people working with him. He'll provide custom solutions for you or your business. He'll put it all together for you. Call him at 248-663-4748. Let him see where you are right now, where you want to be. Create a plan to reach your financial goals, answer all the questions along the way, and, of course, the consultation is complimentary. So call Luke Nowacki at 248-663-4748, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. Advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates, Inc., other marketing names, product, service, reference here, independent Royal Alliance Associates.
One good thing about...
You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Yes, Dennis
One good
Dale.
Thing about Luke, he's a great, honorable, honest guy. You don't have to worry about the Lukester.
Okay, that's good to know. But that's
now, does he pay important. Extra? Does Luke pay extra for that?
That was a $5 tag. It's a
$5 extra. Okay, well, it's worth it. Luke's a great guy. Hey, this is a huge story here, fellas.
Which one?
A Florida state court judge on Tuesday denied Zion Williamson's request to stay discovery into whether he was eligible under NCAA rules when he played his one season at Duke.
All so he's going to do is testify.
No, no, he's not going to. Bob, I'm going to tell you. Tell the story, but I talked to your buddy and our show's legal counsel, Dan Wallach, about that yesterday. But go ahead, tell the story.
Yeah, what did he say?
Dan Wallach said that, yes, that would appear on the surface to be very, very dangerous for the entire game of basketball to have Zion have to admit that he took incentives when he was – the problem is – A lawsuit precedes this one in Florida, in North Carolina, where Gina Ford, the agent who signed him, that contract is deemed illegal. So he couldn't. Well, I have notes on this, but the point is that the North Carolina lawsuit is going to supersede this one. He's not going to. Chances are 98%. He's not going to have to testify in Florida to having taken money beforehand.
Okay, so apparently you know something.
Let me just say this to you. The only way he doesn't testify, and there's only one way he doesn't testify, it's if they do a settlement and give him back some of the money. That's the only way he's going to miss testifying. And he may not testify next week or next month or 6 months from now, but eventually the system requires that he eventually has to testify if it's not settled.
His loss, his contract with Gina Ford that he got out of was deemed illegal. Therefore, she has no say into making him testify about what he did in high school and what he didn't. And that seems to be.
But now you guys can talk about this all you want, but here's the bigger story to me. And you know, my prejudice with both my parents, Duke grads, I don't believe Mike knew anything about this nor anybody else at Duke, but doesn't it seem possible that Duke might have to forfeit every game it played that one season when they had Zion, including a 34-point rout of Kentucky early in the year. You remember what happened to Duke eventually that season? He got hurt. And Duke was eliminated from the NCAA tournament by Michigan State, sending the Spartans to another Final Four under Tom Izzo. I mean, what a mark of shame on the Duke basketball
program.
It's
not going to happen, though. It's not going to happen.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right.
Try and find
you want to
my
talk about
here.
The death of Wes Unseld then?
Sure. Let's talk about the death of one.
He and I were on a cover together in 67 or 68. Yeah, nice man. Yeah.
Really nice guy. Here's a guy who was 6'7" and essentially was a center with the Baltimore and Washington Bullets. He became one of the outstanding rebounders in the game. Yes, going up against Kareem and everybody else every night at 6'7". He's one of the greatest outlet passers of all time. Along with Wilt Chamberlain, Wes Unseld was the only man to ever win both the NBA Rookie of the Year and Most Valuable Player Award in the same season.
Yeah, 6'7" is amazing that he did what he did at 6'7".
Tell me, who were the other two guys on the cover?
Oh, you,
Bobby Orr,
and OJ.
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 Yeah,
yeah, OJ. Your buddy OJ.
No, he's not my buddy.
Somebody sent it that magazine or that cover like last year.
I
remembered it, but yeah, it was a great cover with you on it.
I see it quite a bit, yeah.
The other guys. Okay, now, here's one that I know Eli's going to remember, and I remember it very well. Also, and they're dropping like flies, folks. It's really tough. So Pat Dye, what an ironic name. Pat Dye passed away this week. He was 85. Head coach at Auburn, and when he went there, he inherited a program that was deeply divided after only 3 winning seasons in the previous 6 years. But in 12 years, he turned it around. They won or shared 4 conference titles, always in the top 10. His coaching career ended in November 1992, and he was forced to resign after what else in big-time football? A pay-for-play scandal had rocked the program. Put him on 2 years probation, but naturally he is still regarded as a hero to all the people in Opelika, Alabama. Eli, January 2nd, 1984. The scene, New Orleans. The venue, the Sugar Bowl.
And then Johnny Majors died this week.
Johnny Majors.
Wait a minute, Denny. I'm not finished with this.
Yeah.
Eli, you don't remember that?
Okay, January 2nd.
It was so exciting because Michigan, for the first time, was going to play like a huge, big-time Southern college power. And we were going to see who was better, the Big Ten or the SEC. It was Pat Dye versus Bo in the Sugar Bowl, and we were all up here in the North, at least.
Let me ask a question.
Remember that 9-7 loss? Michigan lost to Pat Dye.
That was a bad season. They were only 6-6, and they went to the they played BYU in a bowl game and got
another. Their ass. Yeah, I remember that too.
Let me ask a question: is it me? Is it perception? But are we having more celebrities die recently the last 3 or 4 months than I've ever seen? Huh? I'm not kidding. It seems to me like we're announcing 2, 3, 4 a day at times.
No.
That's why I say they're dropping like flies. And, and what that's about is this: if you live long enough, as we have. Virtually any person you ever looked up to or was famous or watched on TV, they're going to die. Now, celebrities were dropping dead the same way when we were boys, but we didn't know who these 1920s movie stars were. You know, anything like that. It's just now, and you mentioned, Denny, you want to talk about him? Johnny Majors passed away this week, too.
Just a good coach. I did a couple of shows with him years ago. Nice man. A Southern gentleman from the word go. Totally a Southern gentleman. Yes, sir. No, sir. Good to see you, sir. Look for you. Seeing at the next show. You know, just a great guy.
People forget Johnny Majors is also a great player at Tennessee. He was a single wing tailback. They wound up being head coach at Iowa State, his alma mater. And before Tennessee, he actually won the national title. Remember this? At Pittsburgh in 1976 with Tony Dorsett and that crew. Hell of a career Johnny Majors had. He was 85.
How about I'll do it really quickly. A couple of this day in sports. You know, we had Dick Trusewski, who played in 3 of Sandy Koufax's 4 no hitters. On this day in 1964, he threw his 3rd no hitter against the Phillies, 3-0. Trusewski was with the Dodgers then. 1970, the Padres made Mike Ivey the number 1 pick in the draft. That was a fateful choice that day. And your buddy, Ken Holtzman pitched his 2nd
no-hitter. My man.
Beat the Reds 1-0 in 71. You might have been there then at that time.
You know, I was gambling a little bit in my life, but until Holtzman joined my life, I became a full-time gambler. I've never seen anybody gamble like he does in my life.
Well,
the guy was just an unbelievable machine.
When we started doing the show together back in the 90s, you bitched almost every day about how Raleigh Fingers beat him for 10 grand.
Still owes me 15 grand.
And don't forget, as Eli knows very well, the 2nd greatest Jewish left-handed pitcher in Major League Baseball
Eddie
history.
Holtzman. You ready? This day in 1988, Margot Adams sued Wade Boggs.
Oh, my God.
Alimony. Back to 1953, when Denny was 9 years old in Chicago, the Pittsburgh Pirates, in about a 15-player trade, I had it punched up earlier, but they traded Ralph Kiner and Joe Garagiola to the Cubs in a trade that involved about 15 guys, and they were dancing in the streets in Chicago to get the great Ralph Kiner, who was kind of 31, was already on the downside of his career.
Did I tell you my best Kiner story?
I think you are going to, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Ralph Kiner liked to, shall I say, tipple a little bit during
once
games
in
into the broadcast booth.
Sometimes the Mets. By the way, he was the Mets broadcaster for many
years.
So
sometimes he tippled a lot. So Steve Zabriskie, who was his partner on Mets TV games, told me this many years ago in New York. He and Kiner are doing a game in Montreal. Ralph's actually broadcasting. Zabriskie sitting there when the Mets send up a pinch hitter. They look down at it, and Kiner turns to Zabriskie and shrugs his shoulders, and he mouths the word, "Who? Who is that?" Zabriskie can't believe it. It's number 13. So he looks on, and he kind of still doesn't know who it is. So Zabriskie writes down the name Maz for Lee Mazzilli, of course.
Yeah.
And Ralph never skipped a beat. Pinch hitting for the Mets coming up next. Bill Mazeroski.
Well, one quickie with Wade Boggs. Wade Boggs has a sipping issue, like all the time. I mean, he never takes a day off. And whenever you see him at a dinner, if you've got any history with him at all, he will come. And if you don't see him coming, you better be prepared, because he's going to kiss you right on the lips.
Well, not anymore.
He does it. And he's got me almost every time over the last couple of years.
Okay, we got to say goodbye to our radio listeners at WCW.
Yeah, we need to.
He's a pretty good kisser, by the way.
Thank you for listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Coming up in just a few moments, we got Can't Be Russell. And I think what we ought to do at this point, my last story, kind of a light
yeah,
one.
I got some good news here, too. That'll be my last.
Well, did you hear the Lenny Dykstra story?
Where yes,
he sued again. Ron Darling, because in Darling's book, he alleged that Dykstra yelled racial slurs at the Sox Dennis Boyd prior to Boyd taking the mound during the 86 World
Are you going
Series.
To read the exact quote from the judge?
Let me find the quote from the judge.
Yeah,
Darling said that basically Dykstra, you can't libel him. It'd be impossible to libel him. The judge agreed with Darling's claim that Dykstra has such a terrible reputation, impossible to libel. Here's what the judge said of Dykstra. Based on the papers submitted on this motion prior to the publication of the book, Dykstra was infamous for being, among other things, racist, misogynist, and anti-gay, as well as a sexual predator, drug user, a thief, and an embezzler. Further, Dykstra had a reputation large due to his autobiography of being willing to do anything to benefit him and his team, including using steroids and blackmailing umpires. Considering this information, which is presumably known to the average reader of the book, this court finds that as a matter of law, the reference in the book has not exposed Dykstra to any further, quote, public contempt, ridicule, aversion, or disgrace, or evil opinion of him in the minds of a right-thinking persons.
Well, so- let me tell you something else about Dykstra. We were going to bring him in about 2 years ago for a guy over in Grand Rapids. We do his show every year for the charity at the school. And Dykstra was our normal lead-in because he's friends with all the guys that do come in. And when the Lansing papers, and I don't remember what the guy's name is right offhand, but when the Lansing sports guy got a hold of the story and found out that Dykstra was coming in, he said, "You're going to really bring in Dykstra?" I said, "Yeah, we're going to really bring him in." He says, "You know, I got to write the baggage." I said, "What the hell are you talking about baggage? He's just going to come in and he's going to leave the same night." He said, "I'm not talking about that kind of baggage. I'm talking about the degenerate that he is." I said, "Oh, you know about that?" He said, "Know about it." He said, "You got to be kidding." He says, "He's worse than the Hun." You know, I guess we'll
get him on the show, Denny, if you got his number and you work with him, let's talk to Lenny Dykstra. In fact, Brandon says they've had him on the Drew and Mike show before. Haven't you, Brandon?
Several times. He's a character.
He's a character, boy. And every other word is like a mother something.
Two quick stories. One I have to mention, and that because we talked about it a bunch. Bowling Green baseball has been saved. Did you see that? After we talked about them, absolutely, they abandoned the program due to financial constraints caused by COVID-19. A whole bunch of generous people came through at a fundraiser for Bowling Green baseball. They raised more than $1.5 million to keep that program alive. And how about this? Huntsville, Alabama, which calls itself the hockey capital of the South, University of Alabama Huntsville Hockey was also eliminated. They got a community fundraiser of $500,000 as a goal, and the community and a couple NHL players like superstar Patrick Kane of the Blackhawks and goalie Cam Talbot of Calgary were very generous. They saved that too. Paul Caron, one of our regular listeners, told me about that. So I think it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, That's wonderful.
I'd like to mention some people who are kind enough to send us some donations as we struggle to meet our expenses this month. We're getting close. Can't remember. I think it's Ronald Mitz, $10 a month. Thank you very much. I got a Polish name here. I think I got Michael Sobczynski, $20. And we got some $15 a month from Jeff Witt. Thank you very much. And Kurt Kosmowski, $1 a month. I said $1 is fine. Thank you very much, Kurt. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Tom Parrilli, $121. Doug Whitten, $25. And John James, who I don't think is the guy running for Senate, $425 a month. Thank you very much to our listeners. Appreciate that.
That's very nice. It's amazing to me how it just keeps coming.
It's very, very, very nice. And we're all in this together. In fact, you know, Brandon, help me out here. We have the 760-89 balls line.
Okay.
Do people, when you send it to me, all I see is it written out. Does it automatically transcribe what they verbally say on the phone, or is somebody writing that out?
Sometimes, but I normally write them out because it's easier for me to send you the note rather than the actual message.
Well, how about, is it possible that we take some of the better thing and you clean them up? Maybe people, if they ramble on a little bit, you can clean it up. And let's have a couple of questions. Let's hear from people so we can hear from what they sound like and have them ask a question that way.
That's what I always thought the mailbag was supposed to be.
Yeah, I'd like to get some voicemails. And don't worry about screwing it up. Brandon can make anybody sound great. You really can.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, you have no idea how much editing I have to do in the mailbag to make these letters seem coherent and making them understandable.
Well, so we have a very intelligent
like that. We'll see if Brandon can clean it up.
I can't Bob, believe, that's the I reason can't why you'd say that, Bob.
That you are, Bob.
Why would you say that? So many of them are really intelligently written. Yeah, why would you impugn the literary skills of our audience?
Because while you're right, some of them are indeed really intelligent. Some of them are indeed not.
Okay.
Well,
you want to go to Campy Russell? You want to be screwing around?
I just don't want to insult.
Are we
going to
do the mailbag at all? Okay. We doing the mailbag at all
now?
Yeah, let's do it now.
Oh, okay.
We always do it before the guest, Bob. Yeah. Did you forget what we've done every day since we started the show?
I don't know what you guys are doing. I have no idea what you're doing. All right, here
we go. You've already lost a minute of the mailbag. You're down to 2.5
minutes. Here's the mailbag.
Down to one.
Folks, I think you know by now, you can tweet us all at Eli Zara. Mailman. At MU2Denny.
I am happy.
At Bob Page Sports. I'm trying to give some information to the fans here, but you guys are screwing me up.
I'm
trying to anyway. You ready, Denny?
Yes, we're ready.
Shake your knockers and ring your bells.
He only wakes up during the mailbag when his name is mentioned, as it will be coming up here shortly.
Okay, let him go. Here we go.
The first one, obviously, they want to talk about the Dick Trusewski interview from the other day. Daniel Lee Emery writes, great interview. I could have listened longer to Trixie telling stories.
He was on forever.
Paul Hibbert says, you guys should have Trixie on every month. Love the sound of his cuckoo clock chiming in the background, too.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what, Eli, my friend? There's always somebody in life trying to spoil the proverbial broth, isn't there? So Frank Brusco writes, interview with Trusewski was great. Too bad Eli wouldn't let you ask any questions. Eli gets all giddy and he can't stop. Anyway, the show is great, too. Now, here is the weirdest tweet. Here's the weirdest tweet Eli and I have gotten in a long time. It's headlined, Our Podcast. And here's what it says. Denny McClain, Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, No Filter Sports Podcast, or Eli and HTTPDenny.com. Now starring Dick Trusewski. Don't miss Dick. Sensational history. And this is from Denny McClain. That's right. And he then puts his personal home email address on it.
I blast on the show all the time for my email. I send it out to everybody. Yeah, I sent it.
Well, then
50,000 people get it.
Okay, so for everybody who saw it, what was the picture of the young couple, the man in military dress, getting married at some beautiful outdoor scene somewhere? Why was that on there?
I think that was a mistake, but that was Michelle, I think, and her husband.
I think it came from Denny.com.
I just want to point out.
That's before Michelle kicked them out.
That you spelled Trusewski wrong, and you put the URL with a space between the two words, and that'll never get anybody there.
But that's okay.
Nice try, big fella. Nice try. You are getting technically more proficient day by day. Next letter, please.
Poop that I put up with.
Here comes Jeff Witt, who writes, I grew up in Metro Detroit in the 1980s and 90s, now live in Atlanta. Somehow I stumbled upon your podcast and became a regular listener. Of course, I remembered Eli from his days at WDIV and JBK. Denny, the 31-game winner and fellow aviator. Bob Page. Bob Page? Who the hell is Bob Page? Never even heard of this guy before. Well, that's because, Jeff, I had a career upgrade, and I moved to New York in 1988. In fact, Bill at Hoops to Go tweeted me yesterday, Bob, where you been? Miss you on the New York sports scene. That answers your question. Anyway, Jeff continues. Then I binge-watched old episodes of Sports View Today on YouTube. Now I'm sorry I missed the original run of Bob and later Denny taking his place in a weekly verbal sparring match with their TV co-host, who never failed to reach for a personal attack once his argument was lost. Gee, Denny, I wonder who he's talking about there. Not the noted broadcast journalist, Ron Cameron Swayze.
The unnamed one. Next one. Go ahead. Enough of that letter.
Anyway, so he just goes on about how much he loves the podcast and especially got a kick, almost drove off the road laughing when Eli did it, when Denny did his mailman song recently. Oh, and also, Eli, I put a couple bucks in the tip jar so I don't feel as guilty about skipping the commercials. So that was nice. Here's
don't remind people they can do that. My God.
Here's something from our Ask No Filter.
The self-inflicted wounds of the mailbag. Go ahead.
You just got finished again putting our entire audience to sleep with your sports silliness.
Go ahead, Bob.
Denny loves the mailbag. We love the mailbag. So anyway, he writes, I didn't think my small donation would be podcast worthy. You nailed my last name perfectly. And on a side note, my son Grant was awarded the Polish Sports Hall of Fame College Scholarship in 2016.
Congratulations.
And I'm going to tell you in a moment who that comes from. And I'll get back.
Yeah. let's take a 5-minute break while you find the name.
It's great to be prepared.
Oh, this is deadly.
Oh, it was from Paul Rezcik. And he again thanks us for doing the show.
I can see people going from their podcast app to their weather app to see what the weather's going to be today.
Tuning in Ron Cameron.
Go ahead.
This one's for Denny. That always gets his ears to kind of perk up there a little bit. Al Kovac was able to get out of Dodge for a while. And he says, I wrote this note after an extended weekend in northern Michigan where the bars, restaurants, and stores were open, and it almost seemed normal again.
Really?
Now, Denny seems to have a pretty good handle on the status of the baseball negotiations. And it made me wonder, who were the major leaguers who laid the foundation of the players' union? And is there any representation in the players' union now for retired ball players? He adds, if Denny needed a second job, it would seem as though he'd be an ideal rep for retired players.
Were the guys Marvin Miller in the beginning?
Marvin Miller, one thing about Marvin was that he really kept us apprised of everything. He was great when it came to that. Everybody kind of became a rep on your own team. I mean, we just did. Yes, we had what guy named, and we had an assistant name, but more or less, Marvin kept everybody in tune all the time, and he was one of those guys that recorded everything to history. So from the very first day that we appointed Marvin, he was all over this thing. He was just great.
Posthumously elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I also read that Michigan State's own Robin Roberts back in the 50s was one of the prime movers of the Major League Baseball Players Association. Somebody or some guys had to stand up, Denny, before you got to the big leagues and say, we need a union and we're going to get one.
Well, I'll give you a quick 15 seconds here. When you got to the big leagues, when I first got there, they gave you the option of joining the union or not. And if you didn't, and I think it was like $8 or $9 a month you had to pay to be a member of the union. Well, you know what? When you're 19, 20 years old, I mean, $8 or $9 a paycheck doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're only making $7,000 a year, that's a lot of money. And I know guys, and I know guys today who never got in the pension. John Warden is one. Don McMahon was another one. He didn't jump in for $7 or $8 a month. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of guys that never jumped into pension.
There aren't too many. I'm thinking in basketball, Oscar Robertson, and in hockey, right, Ted Lindsay. I'm trying to think of the players. Of course, Messersmith and Dave McNally are the ones that pushed for it.
Jimmy Lyons always writes this good stuff. And as usual, it's about Dennis Dale McLean for the most part. Fellas, another great show Monday. Great interview with Trixie. What a life and career.
Great.
I love all the former Tigers of my youth that you guys always have on your show. Denny, when you said you interviewed a NASCAR driver back in 1993, I thought maybe you'd had on Jeff Gordon as a rookie or maybe Cale Yarborough near the end of his career. But when you said it was Brad Keselowski when he was 3 years old, I almost drove off the road.
We had several people on because when the Grand Prix came,
we always
were able to get them. Yeah. And because you and I went out and did some bits out there, too.
Yeah.
But I know we had Gordon on once or twice. And then some guys from Europe we had on all the time because they were just looking for money. They'd go on the air. And as you said, well, how are you doing with the cars and everything? Well, we've got a telephone number. If you would call us, it would certainly help. And we want to tell you how to get a hold of us, when you can get a hold of us. We're open all the time. And the guy would go on for 5 or 6 minutes, and you'd say, thank you. Good to see you again.
Okay, Bob, that's it.
And then he closed his note by saying, whatever weed Eli is now giving you, Denny, I'd like to have some too.
Mailbag is over. I'm officially declaring it over.
Well, let's talk. There's two against one here.
And it's two against one about that lame this day in sports stuff, too.
All right.
Eli, time for Campy.
Thank you. We mentioned in the beginning of the show that this week, the Free Press sports writer, prep basketball writer, Mick McCabe, named Pontiac Central's Campy Russell part of the All-State of Michigan prep team of the last 50 years. Campy's there with Magic Johnson, Dan Marley, Glenn Rice, and Shane Battier. Quite a cast. After twice being selected as the State of Michigan's High School Player of the Year, he went on to U of M, and in 74 was Big Ten Player of the Year, led the league in scoring, and made All-American. He was drafted 8th number overall by the Cavs. So he played 6 years in Cleveland, traded to the Knicks in 80 on national TV that season, 1980, Knicks versus the Celtics. Rick Barry, Bill Russell were the analysts, as Campy went after the reigning rookie of the year, Larry Bird.
38 all. Campy Russell with Larry Bird on him. And Bird was looking as tough as you can get, but he got it anyway. Had a hand in the face, and he still was able to drop it. Campy now with 6 points. Larry Bird with 14 points. Russell in there hurrying down the floor. Russell at the other end, and now they're just exchanging baskets. Henderson batted away by Richardson. Here comes Campy Russell. Bird behind him. Campy Russell got down there in a hurry.
What a career. Campy joins us now. Welcome to the show, Campy. What does it feel like to have us mention your accomplishments at each level, high school, college, and pro, so many years ago, but it was you, and what's it like to hear it reviewed again?
Well, to me, I think it's a great honor to even be having this conversation today with Eli, as well as Bob Page, and then the great Denny McClain. So to me, just the fact that I'm still being recognized as a solid player or a good player in the state of Michigan, as well as the University of Michigan, as well as playing in the pro level. So all those are great accomplishments without a doubt. For me, I think the biggest thing is that when I hear that type of stuff about being one of the top players in the state of Michigan, I definitely have to say that all of us that are part of that first team is standing on the shoulders of a lot of great players that have come out of the state of Michigan. And, you know, how people go by even determining that, and I know it's all an opinion, but I'm very honored by it. But at the same time, there's just so many guys that have come from the state of Michigan that have outstanding games and outstanding careers that it is an honor, but at the same time, it's very humbling at the same time.
You don't let it go to your head.
You know, when you talk about the city of Detroit, you're talking about George Gervin. You're talking about Spencer Haywood. You're talking about Lindell Reason. You're talking about, you know, just so many guys. My brother, Frank, my other brother, Walker Russell. I mean, we can go all across the state, and there's been so many great players. L.C. Bowen from out there in Benn Harbor. I mean, it's just been so many. So it is really a humbling thing for me. But at the same time, I'm very aware of all the greatness that were around me, as well as the things that have put me in position to be considered for this honor at this particular point.
Campy, here's another outstanding player from the city of Detroit. Your greatest rival in high school, That, of course, was Lindsey Hairston of Detroit Kettering High School. I tell people this story, and they don't believe it. You go to Michigan. Lindsey goes to Michigan State. Lindsey takes your high school point guard, Bill Glover. You take Lindsey's high school point guard, Joe Johnson. Tell us about that.
Well, to me, I just think it's just something that happens. I think we all had different destinations, but let me tell you a quick story. Initially, Lindsey and I was going to go to the same school, no matter where it was, whether it was going to be Michigan or Michigan State, because that is something that we both talked about, you know, coming up as high school players. And after we were rivalries, but at the same time, we were rivalries, but we were also very good friends in terms of I've been over to his family's house. I met his mom, them, and we had a good relationship. So I just think that kind of happened in terms of Bill going on to Michigan State. And then Joe Johnson coming to Michigan. That was a good occurrence for all of us. It just so happens that, you know, at the end of the day, we were a little bit more successful than they were. But I think a lot of that just has to do with the, I'll say, the camaraderie that we had on our team in terms of the close-knit teams that we had at Michigan.
Yeah, you played twice for the state championship in high school, and you lost to Will Robinson's team. I think you lost to Pershing one year and Kettering the next. You get to Michigan, and freshmen can't play back then. So you only played 2 years at Michigan, yeah. But your last year, 74, like I said, Big Ten Player of the Year, All-American. You had a decision after your junior year. Do I come back or do I turn pro? You made the right decision turning pro. I know that. However, you questioned it later because, you know, as thinking about the team, when you look back on it, you made the right decision, but how come you allowed yourself to second guess it even?
Well, I don't think it was necessarily a second guess. It was more about when you just kind of look back over your life and you kind of look at some of the things that you may have said, well, maybe I shouldn't have done this or maybe I should have done that. But to me, I think it all came down to the success that we had there at Michigan. It had a lot to do with our relationship as a team. When I talked about, you know, Steve Grody, or I talked about Joe Johnson, or C.J. Kupek, or Chuck Rogers, or Bill Ayler, John Robinson, and then you add Wayman Britt to that mix. You know, we were had a great relationship with each other, not just on the basketball court, but off the court. So to me, that was the thing that I regretted, because I truly believe that if I would have stayed, that we would have won the national championship that year, because if you look back at that team that I was with, minus me, that team went on to lose to, I think, UCLA or somewhere out in the Western bracket. But I would say that with me there, we would have definitely had a much better chance. And again, that's the only reason why I kind of regretted it. But at the same time, it was truly the best thing that I could have done at that time. Because at that time, to me, as far as college basketball was concerned, I was just kind of done with college basketball. I just thought that I needed to move on to a different level just for my sake and as well as for my family's sake as well.
Can I just jump in here again? Because sure. It's incredible when you think back to how life has changed. You had to go hardship. In other words, you wouldn't have been able to leave after your junior year. It seems incomprehensible. Did your father have to show his tax return? What if you had more money? You wouldn't have been able to go pro. The hardship rule. Explain to people what that was and how bizarre it really is.
Well, to me, I don't know all the nuances about the hardship rule. I do know one thing, that Spencer Haywood set the tone because of his greatness in the Olympics, his greatness at University of Detroit, his great awareness of the possible benefit that it would have on college basketball. You know, so for me, it wasn't about the how much money my dad then made. We were, you know, there was seven boys and three girls in my family. But we was not in a position where we were, you know, poor by no stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I could help my family. And to me, that's what this whole thing was about more than anything. But as it relates to trying to demonstrate that you was financially able to go or wasn't able to go, to me, it was just more about it was time for me to go. I wanted to be a part of that. And again, Spencer Haywood opened the door for all of us, which allowed everybody to benefit from that, even to this day.
And you talk a lot about John Beilein. I saw a number of articles last night, and he was quite a coach. You were kind of the guy for him, weren't you? I mean, you really depended upon him. He helped your game a lot.
But wait a minute, time out. He didn't play for John Beilein.
But for Johnny Orr.
No, I played with Johnny Orr.
Right.
Johnny Orr was my coach. Right. Well, as it relates to Johnny Orr, to me, I think Johnny Orr was a he was a perfect guy for me, and I think he was a perfect guy for the Michigan team, Michigan as a whole at that time. I know Johnny took a lot of pressure from particularly my sophomore year when we had a very good basketball team. They were, at least on paper. We had a Henry Wilmore. We had Ernie Johnson, Ken Brady, Dave Hart. I mean, we had a very good basketball team along with Joe Johnson and myself and CJ and those guys. But that team was not successful primarily because, in my view, it was the players, you know, because we could not come together as a group of guys. And to me, that was the detriment that Johnny Orr almost paid for, because he was not able to get us all on the same page. And in some cases, we were not able to get ourselves on the same page because of whatever it was. But we truly had a great team. And to me, I saw something recently about they were ranking the top players in University of Michigan's history. And I couldn't understand for the life of me why Henry Wilmore was so low on that totem pole, because that was a spectacular player in my view. As well as, and I know we're not talking about this, but when I looked at that list, and then you talk about Roy Tarpley, so for me, he was the best center in the history of Michigan basketball, University of Michigan basketball, in terms of his overall abilities. But that's neither here nor there. But Johnny Orr, to me, was an excellent coach there. And Jim Dutcher also assisted him along with Bill Frieda later on. So we had a great team, a great bunch of guys, but that sophomore year, in my view, was a disaster for all of us.
Yeah, Wilmore, he was the star there when I was a freshman. He just didn't have many good players around him. You guys got better, after you arrived. You know, Denny mentioned Beilein as opposed to Orr, but you were very much behind Beilein when you were interviewed, you know, as he was the coach at Michigan, when people asked you about him. And then he comes to Cleveland, where, by the way, you are still in charge of alumni relations. What happened to
Beilein? And he's on the radio broadcast, too.
Yeah. What happened to Beilein down there? He just seemed a classic case of a great college coach that just could not relate to the modern day athlete. I know it may be hard because you're so close to the team, and there may be things you can't reveal because you're paid by the team. But what went wrong with Beilein in Cleveland?
To me, I really think it's just a tough transition for anybody, particularly coming from the college ranks, where as a coach in college, I think you have, in some cases, total control over the players, you know, and in some cases, that basketball program. And I just think it was just a tough transition for him, you know, evident by the fact that, you know, at some point in time during the course of the season that, you know, he resigned. So to me, I thought coming in that he would be the guy for this young basketball team. But I thought that, you know, as things wore on, I just thought that he recognized that it was more to this league than what he thought. And I think it really, in some cases, maybe beyond basketball, you know, in terms of, I think when you coach at any level, I think you have to be able to be versatile. You have to be able to adjust to situations. You have to take on a lot of different roles, you know, from a role from being the coach to, in some cases, being a father figure, in some cases, being a counselor, in some cases, just being able to be versatile and create an environment of a good relationship with your team. And if you have that, then you have a great chance of being successful. So I'm sure as Coach Beilein looked at this, you know, he just felt as though that it was time for him to go for his good as well as for the good of the organization.
Campy, you've been around the game a long time. What do you think about the new stuff coming out? They want to pay the players.
That is, for me, one of those things that everything evolves over time. I'm sure when you were playing, Denny, and you look at, you know, the amount of money you were making then versus the amount of money they're making now, know, when you look back at it, you say, man, I should have been making just as much money as those guys. So for me, these are just things that evolves over time. So from a standpoint of what do I have to say about it, I say if they can make it happen and the kids can get paid or whatever that is for using their identity or their likeness, then for me, hey, that's just a part of things changing. And sometimes you go along with the changes. Sometimes the changes are going to be fought. But for the most part, if that happens, hey, more power to the NCAA, more power to the kids or the students. That's how I look at it.
Well, God bless you, because you're one of the few that have come out that strong for it. Because I believe in it, too. I believed in it for a long time.
Campy, we've been talking on this show for a while. And our opinion here is that with all the brouhahas going on in professional sports, they should just cancel the seasons. Now, I know, A, that you'd like to get back to work. B, I know with your club, you ain't going to get back to work. What do you think about the NBA resuming in late summer, playing games in one place, Orlando, and with no fans in attendance?
You know, at this point, I'm not sure what they have decided to do. It's hard for me to speak about those kind of things without having something definitive.
The word is that the NBA has accepted, you know, the deal, and they're going to go ahead.
If that is their plan, then, and the commissioner is behind it and our owners are behind it, then, hey, I'm for it. Because, you know, I'm sure a lot of our fans is sitting there wanting to see sports go on and to enjoy basketball, to enjoy baseball, to enjoy football, to enjoy all the sports that we love. So for me, if that is the situation, then I am 100% for it, whether the Cavaliers is playing or not, because I just believe that, you know, everybody needs to get back to some sort of normalcy. And right now, as we all know, a lot of things have not been normal.
Let's get back to your career. You played 6 years with Cleveland and then two with the Knicks. We heard a little bit when you went against Larry Bird in a game in 1981. The second season, 75-76, finally the Cleveland, when they were called the Cadavaliers, they had all types of, you know, awful history with Ted Stepien. And
that's my nickname. Give me some credit.
And all that stuff. And so a second year, you play against the Bullets, and I believe you finally win a series, a huge, exciting seven-game series. And you were able to unseat Wes Unseld, who several years later won a championship with Washington. He just died a couple of days ago. We kind of eulogized him a little bit. Talk about him and the era, some of the great players back then in the mid-70s, and Unseld in particular.
Well, when you talk about Wes Unseld, I met Wes Unseld back when I was maybe in junior high, up at Dave Bing and Howie Landis basketball camp up in the Poconos. And one of the things that stands out for me when I think of Wes Unseld, particularly when I was a young man, a young child, or just a junior high player, is seeing him up in the Poconos and listening to him about the art of rebounding, looking at how big this guy was, not so much height, but just girth and strength. And just, you know, taking in some of the things that he talked about relative to rebounding. But as we all know, Wes Unseld has went on to be the Rookie of the Year and the world champion, Hall of Famer, one of the top rebounders to ever play in the league for somebody that was only 6'7", 6'8". So when I think of Wes Unseld, I think of just a great man, a great influence of the game, as well as, you know, going on to be a general manager with the Washington Bullets, now the Wizards. So for me, he has definitely have a mark on the NBA and in basketball. So for me, it was a really interesting thing to play against he and Dave Bing in the playoffs, particularly, again, because I went to Dave's basketball camp, and now here I am in the NBA and playing against Dave and Wes Unseld and Alvin Hayes and those great players. And it just so happened that we beat them, but we beat them primarily because of the versatility of our young basketball team. And we were playing with 10 guys that really could play at a high level. And to me, that's what that game came down to, was the fact that we made a lot of key baskets and we were just a young, up-and-coming, fearless basketball team at that particular time.
Who was the coach or the teacher that made you the player that you became? I mean, who was the guy responsible for saying, Campy, we're going to do this today, we're going to do this tomorrow, we're going to make everything happen together?
Well, for me, I think it starts right there on 66 Earl Moore in Pontiac, Michigan, with my brothers that had came before me, number one. Number two, I think it had a lot to do with the community that I came up with in Pontiac, Michigan, with all the mentoring and all of the caring and love from my neighborhood, from my community, from a multitude of men and women that impacted my life. But from a basketball standpoint, you know, I look at it this way. My abilities took off when I went to Dave Bing's All-Pro basketball camp in the Poconos.
Wow.
And the person that I give a lot of credit for assisting me in those areas, not just in basketball, but just in the person that I am beyond my mother and father, is probably Dave Bing and Howard Lander, because of what they taught me at that particular time about basketball as well as about life. But the guy that really drove me was the guy named Ralph Simpson. And if anybody's from the city of Detroit, you know who Ralph Simpson is.
Sure.
But as a ninth grader, I went up there to Bing's basketball camp, and this guy really beat me down so badly that I said to myself, the next time I see this guy, he will see that I'm not the player that he beat up on when I was in the ninth grade, and he might have been in the 12th grade or something like that. But he was the catalyst of me understanding that what I need to do to become a much better basketball player, and definitely All-Pro basketball camp and Dave Bing and Howie Land really helped propel me, because they really helped change my game, where I became more of a multi-purpose person as opposed to a 6'8 center like most of everybody played. Even in high school, I played center. But I was able to dribble the ball, pass the ball, rebound the ball, just understand how to play the game. So it also helped me grow as a player because I had multi-skill sets. And then I always had great players playing with me in terms of Tony Styles at Pontiac Central, Bill Glover, Jerry Ratliff, and all those guys. So for me, I was fortunate to be around a lot of great young players, but more important, I was fortunate to grow up in the city of Pontiac, where there was so much support in that city. Going to a great high school where it was a great academic school. It was a school that was very diverse at that time. It was just the perfect stage for me, which helped, in my view, propel me to be the person that I am today. But I also have to give a lot of credit to my mom and father, as well as my brothers and sisters.
Now, you know, you were born in Jackson, Tennessee. Did the family wind up in Pontiac as part of that so-called the Black migration to work in the auto factories in the 30s and 40s? How did you get from Tennessee to here?
Well, you know, it was all about employment. And my dad was he worked on a farm down south. You know, did a lot of the grunt work, the hard work that was done down there. And he wanted to do something else. He wanted to create a better life for his family. And so he did, like my other uncles and his brothers and his sisters, they all migrated to Detroit, Pontiac, Flint, Grand Rapids, wherever that may be, because they were looking for a better way of life. So I came here probably at the age of 3. I think it was like 55 when we got here. So for me, that is why he came here, because he was looking for a better life. And truly, coming to Pontiac was definitely a better life for all of us. And it really put us all in positions to be the family that we are today, but more importantly, the people that we are today because of that migration here by my dad and my mom.
Did he work in the auto factory?
Yes, he did. He worked in the auto factory. My dad was the kind of guy that one of the things I always tell people, just a short story here, is that when he moved us on into Pontiac into on the street called Earl Moore, it was a little small bungalow house with two bedrooms, a basement, an attic, and one bathroom.
And 10 kids.
And there were seven kids, and there was 10 kids now,
oh,
and the mom and
God.
Dad. And then there were some uncles there at the house, and there was always cousins there as well.
Oh,
geez. But the issue was, I mean, the great thing about all that is, it was about family.
Yeah, that's right. It was all about family.
This piece of property didn't have anything to do with the house. No. It had to do with the property that was surrounding it. And all the property that was surrounding that house was, there was apple trees, pear trees, grape trees, all the fruits and stuff that you wanted. And my dad was a farmer. So he farmed that land to really help feed all of us, and not just us, but even the neighborhood. So that speaks volumes to, again, the kind of guy that he was and the foresight that he had and what he understood his family needed.
Campy, did anybody ever reach out to you and try to ask you to coach a basketball team?
No. And to me, I can really say that I think we all would like to have done that.
Sure.
You know, whether it was you coaching or managing in baseball or what have you, but sometimes those opportunities don't come about.
You're
and
right.
And the only thing you continue to do is just to forge your way and continue to do what you're capable of doing and continue to be the person that you can be and continue to just try to put yourself in the best position you possibly can to be able to take care of your family.
Yeah, you're right.
And to me, it wasn't so much about coaching in this league. I think I was fortunate enough to go back to the University of Michigan at 48 years old, finish up my degree, and then having the opportunity to come to the Cleveland Cavaliers and to be a big part of that organization from the time that Dan took over our organization or bought into our organization. I also have to look back to Gordon Gunn, and who was the owner at the time that I first got there. But then Dan came on, and he continued to grow that franchise and putting this franchise in position to be a world championship team, but at the same time, be able to just be a great organization. So I've been very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in today, but I believe that I was groomed for this position that I'm in today because of all the people that I stand on their shoulders because of how they helped me grow and develop.
It sure sounds like it.
You played 6 years for Cleveland and two for New York. You had an awful knee injury in 1982 that basically cost you your career, but you must be thankful that you got 8 years. And in 78-79, 22 points a game. You made the All-Star game, so you got a long, meritorious career.
Eli, I wanted to ask him about that since you brought it up. You had that one great season, Campy, and you made the All-Star team, but you never were able to get back to that level, and you hadn't done it before. So why were you so great that one year and not quite as great the other years?
Well, to me, I just think it was, for me, it was just a natural transition, you know, from my first year. I think I may have played maybe 55, 60 games. And did not play that much. The very next year, everything kind of took off for me in terms of me leading our teams and scoring in that second year, third year, fourth year, making the All-Star team. So my game continued to grow during those times. And then after that year, I think I got injured, where I had this real bad groin injury. And Mike Mitchell and I were playing together at that particular time, and I just had an injury that I recuperated from that following year, and then I was traded to the Knicks in 79-80. And even going to the Knicks, we had some very good basketball teams there. I was playing with Michael Ray Richardson, Ray Williams, Bill Cartwright, Sly Williams, Marvin Webster. Coach Red Holtzman was the coach at that particular time. So to me, all the things that had occurred to me or with me was just a part of this life that we travel. And yes, I did get injured. And the good news with that, the way I look at it, is it allowed me to do other things and move on with my life without trying to go overseas and play and stay over there until I'm 40 years old. And then when I come back over here, what tools do I have? What tools do I have to transition back into this world? So to me, I look at it that that was one of the best things that ever happened to me. In retrospect, yes, I wanted to play a lot of years, but the fact that I didn't, the fact that I had this injury, I think that injury was a godsend as well, because yes, I tore an ACL, but I have not ever had any issues with that knee since. Good. And even at the age of 68 years old, I'm still very mobile with it and had not had any issues with it. So I look at it as all those things that occurred was a great blessing. Yeah. And the question was, why did I not continue to ascend? Hey, you know, those things happen in our league. And the only thing you can do, and Denny knows this himself, the only thing you can do is continue to do your best and try to perform at your best every time you step on the floor. And that's what I try to do.
I'm going to ask you the toughest question of the day. Is LeBron James the best basketball player we've ever seen?
Well, you know, that is not a tough question for me. I think when you I don't think anybody can say any one person was the best basketball player or the best baseball player ever. You cannot. I mean, you can have it. You can talk about it just to create great conversation.
Sure.
But you can't definitively say who was the best basketball player ever. And for me, if you push me to say who that person was,
pick one player.
I would say Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
There you go. Yeah, we all agree with that. We all agree with that.
That's what I would. That's what I would say. And then the second guy, for me, I would say Magic Johnson.
No kidding.
You know,
I'll be
there. Again, those are all great conversations, and I think that's the beauty of it, because that is why this game of basketball has grown so much, because of those type of conversations.
Yeah.
And people are interested in who, whether it's Michael Jordan, whether it's LeBron James now, and nobody can take anything from LeBron James either.
Right.
Spectacular body, spectacular mind, spectacular skill set, you know, just a spectacular person because of the things that he do on the court as well as off the court. So you can't take away from anybody, but it's hard to determine to say this is the guy. And
yeah, it's just a conversation. The
even
whole
when I
say
about Kareem, I can't.
Yeah.
Anybody can argue with me about that, which is the beauty of our sport.
The great thing about it is now he's going to be a big-time movie producer. I mean, and I'll guarantee you this, he'll be just as successful at that as he is with that three-pointer.
I want to bring up a difficult subject, and that is we all lost a friend and colleague recently. When your Cleveland Cavaliers broadcasting colleague, Fred McLeod, who worked in Detroit for so many years, shockingly and suddenly passed away. Tell us about Fred.
Well, I've known Fred since my probably second or third year in the league when he was doing some broadcasting or I'm not saying broadcasting, I'm going to say some television work down here locally. So I've known Fred for quite a while, and I knew him when he was in Detroit, and then having the opportunity for him to come back to Cleveland and be our play-by-play guy, just a spectacular guy, a guy that has so much passion for life, for basketball, for his family, just a guy that, you know, I looked upon as being a brother because of the relationship that we had with each other. So when that happened, when I look back at that, I know the season ended. I saw Fred before the season ended. And then this death knock.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a blow for all of us, because even to this day, I think about the fact that I don't remember seeing him. I don't remember talking to him prior to him passing, because normally we play golf during the summer and we did not do that. And so I miss Fred as a friend and brother. I miss Fred as the voice of the Cleveland Cavaliers. I miss him because of what he brought to our organization. And to me, he will always be missed because of his greatness, because of his voice, because of his enthusiasm for basketball, as well as for the Cleveland Cavaliers, as well as for the city of Cleveland.
Really appreciate you joining us today. Great to relive some of those times. We do go way, way back. Talk too much about
Yes, we do.
The old days.
We go so far back, Eli, that again, you and I had this conversation just the other day about, I said, Eli Zarek. And when I think of Eli Zarek, I think about WJZZ Radio, the jazz station in Detroit.
You couldn't because get commentary anywhere else. Back then, there weren't too many places to get commentary, and nobody was doing it. And I was the only one, and it was great that people like you would listen to me. Trust me, it's a thrill I take to this day. Yes, for sure.
You were a trailblazer in that commentary piece, but you had the right stage in terms of being on JZZ, because there was so many diversified people, diversity that was a part of JZZ because of this jazz platform. I just remember your name. I remember that voice, you know, Eli Zarek, Kevin Usery, Rosetta Hines, you know, those folks to me, they drove JZZ, all three of you guys. I'm sure there were some other people that I'm going to miss,
but
I just remember listening to JZZ.
Campy, great talking to you again. I hope we run into each other again down the road, and really appreciate you joining us, and good luck to you and the organization. Appreciate it.
Thank you
Campy.
Very much,
thanks, Eli. Campy. Thanks a million.
Reaching out. Denny, take care.
You too. Bob, be good.
Paige, take care.
All right,
well,
man.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
There's a couple.
Eli, I'm such a man of consummate taste. When you look at Campy and what the NBA players were listening to on the radio back then, WJZZ and Jazz. Now compare it to what NBA players today are listening to.
That's right.
You know, right. I like the old days better.
Great talking to Campy. Thanks for all you for joining us. Have a great weekend. We will see you again on Monday. Be safe.
Bye, buddy.